Well, good morning, everybody. It was breezy, as everybody's talked about. I woke up about 4 o'clock. I've done that, I think, every night here at the feast. For some reason, I wake up at 4 o'clock and lay there and think for an hour before I go back to bed. Or go back to sleep. I'm in bed. I wish I would think more often during the day, but while I was awake, I was listening to the wind whistle past. Our window was open about a quarter of an inch. And it sounded like the mountain was singing, you know, with the breeze going by, and then the water started coming. It rained by the way, at that time, quite a little bit. And so you had the raindrops putting a little bit of a rhythmic beat to the music that the whistling wind was playing. And I don't know, I thought it was quite beautiful. And I was glad I was in bed and not out there in it, though. Well, this is beautiful time of the year, the time of harvest, the time of gathering together as we do every year to be together and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. It reminds me of another time. You know, many of you are going on the dinner train this evening, and we went on the train out of Cass the other day and toured the short run up to the top of the mountain where the logging camp was. Quite fascinating, and enjoyed the steam engine ride and all. Reminds me of another train connected to the Feast of Tabernacles. Is one that trails out behind a white dress. And I remember very distinctly, she said, "Dad, you're on my dress. Dad, Dad!" And then my father-in-law lifted his foot, and Linda was able to continue down the aisle so that we could carry on with our wedding 35 years ago. This is a rare feast that we have two anniversaries. We've had two 35th anniversaries this week. The first was the 3rd of October, happened to be the first holy day, and then we got married, though, in Squaw Valley on the third day of the feast in 1974. So we had two anniversaries this week, and I want to wish my wife a very happy, and well, two very happy anniversaries, I guess I'd have to say. I had 35 years twice doesn't mean 70, but it's been a great 35. And it's always nice for us to be able to remember that at feast time. Otherwise, on the scene around the world today and in America, we have politics. Or as Christ might refer to it, politics schmolitics. That's the world's way of doing things. And with the politics, we have economic tough times, economic trials and difficulties. Some of you maybe are experiencing that. Maybe you've been laid off of whatever job or career that you were engaged in as a result of this recession, which borders on depression. And we're not done yet. If you've read a history timeline of the Great Depression in the 1930s, there was a drop off in 28. That's when the stock market fell, but it didn't. The depression's depth did not hit till about 1932 for most of the country. And then it hit. And then they had stimulus packages. And the stock market would jump up like it did the past 6 months. But mainly, it was climbing the mountain so it could ski back down. And it did that up and down, up and down, up and down. What finally brought the world out of the deep depression of the 1930s was World War II. Now, there's an economic stimulus for you, but not the one you want in a nuclear age, by any means. You stop and think about those things, and we see what's happening in America and the movement, you know, because we have a new government regime who really don't think like America has traditionally thought. And it makes you wonder where the America we once knew years ago has gone. Perhaps the best-known British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, once stated, "Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that man has tried from time to time," in the way Churchill would deliver it. A wry bit of wit drawn from a very deep well and a remarkably keen historical observation. Sir Winston might have been considered the 20th century's preeminent historian had he not been so busy running the free world for the first half of World War II. But this comment is as instructive for today as when he made the statement in the decade of the dictators of the 1940s. The question is, where did all those other forms of government that man has tried from time to time go wrong? And in what ways is democracy not perfect or all-wise, as he said? What is the major failing of the governments of man? This is a fitting time to consider that, because it leads us then to the second half of the sermon, or the two-thirds of it, is how will Jesus Christ's millennial government differ in form from the governments of mankind? What will make a difference? Or do we, I think sometimes we tend to think, well, the government of God rule the world tomorrow, and the birds will sing, and the wind won't blow, and it'll only rain at night, and not after 8 in the morning, and the sun will shine brightly, and white fluffy clouds will flow across the skies, and everything will be sweetness and light. Did you ever stop and think, well, what will we do during the millennium? And being as how we're a sort of ruling as kings and priests of Jesus Christ for 1,000 years, what will our people do? I mean, nuts and bolts, what will they do? Well, that has a lot to do with form of government. Now, let's analyze, before we jump into that, and look at the key policies. In fact, the key economic policies of Christ's government in the world to come. Before we jump into that, let's do an analysis. Brief and hard-hitting, and I have a joke in the middle of it. A brief analysis of man's form of governments, typically defined by their economic policies. You know, we know that it's a proverb in American politics that the nation votes with its pocketbook. And one of the key ways that presidents have been elected is to ask, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Or not? You know, this is what one line was. This is the worst economy in 50 years. That was said in the 90s. It was wrong. It wasn't the worst economy in 50 years. That was the dot-com crash that we had gone into in the 90s, and everything that should be up is down, and everything that should be down is up. You remember those words, all kinds of slogans that have come out of presidential campaigns. Economic policies are critical factors in any form of government, and God has a set of them that will form and shape a great deal of the day-to-day society for people in the world tomorrow, and obviously for us as the spirit beings who are governing them and overseeing them. Thomas Sowell once said, in analyzing our first form of government, Marxist communism, Thomas Sowell, of course, is one of America's keenest minds and leading thinkers right now on things historical and such. He said, most people who read the Communist Manifesto, which is what communism's all based on, Karl Marx wrote that, well, primarily wrote that, most people who read the Communist Manifesto probably have no idea that it was written by a couple of young men who had never worked a day in their lives, and who nonetheless spoke boldly in the name of the workers. Remember the slogan of communism? Well, maybe you don't. That was a long time ago. Bolsheviks in 1917. Was anybody alive here in 1917? Well, it's a history thing then. Workers of the World Unite was the Communist Manifesto. One of my favorite books about communism was George Orwell's Animal Farm, because it just makes fun of it from start to finish. Very funny indeed. Here's how it works, you know, in simplistic terms. The government owns everything, all the businesses and all the land. No free enterprise is allowed, none. The government provides all the services, education, healthcare, vacation, any kind of opportunity. The government provides it or not at their whim. Here's the theory of communism. Each is given food, clothing, shelter, etc., according to his need. What is really tiny fine print says, if the party feels like it, the party being the government. Turn, if you would, to Acts chapter 2. Lest we misunderstand circumstances in the Church of God historically. Now, we know that Acts chapter 2 is the beginning of the church, the famous sermon on the day of Pentecost that Peter gave. Oh, I forgot to mention, in communism, you have no personal freedoms. None. In many respects, it's the antithesis of what America has traditionally stood for. Acts chapter 2, verse 44. Now, here we have suddenly 3,000 people baptized, where before you had 120 faithful disciples of Jesus Christ. That morning, you had 120 names. There might have been kids included that weren't included in the list of names. Might have been adults. We don't know. So it might have been 150, maybe 200. By the end of the day, you had 3,000 people who were baptized. They didn't baptize children. So then the church, in overall numbers, like we count our attendance, may have been around 5,000 or so, maybe more. In one day, poof, like that. I'll get to the other circumstance in a minute. Let's read verse 44. Now all who believed were together and had all things in common, and sold their possessions and goods, and divided them among all as anyone had need. See, that is sometimes referred to as Christian communism. Was it the form of church government that Christ dictated? Was it a form of church government at all? It was not. Bear in mind that if you read earlier in the chapter, you find that there are people from all over the Roman Empire and the other empire to the east that you don't know about, but they're mentioned earlier, the Parthian Empire. We'll get into that, by the way, tomorrow in the Tribe Tracker's Guide to History. I haven't told you about the Parthians yet. You had people from all over Europe and the Middle East and elsewhere who converged. The people were Jews, religious Jews, or Jewish proselytes, converts to Judaism. And they made a pilgrimage that particular holy day season, being Pentecost, to Jerusalem. A lot of them got converted that day, or shortly thereafter. They had planned to stay on their pilgrimage for a certain length of time. That's what Second Tithe was for. But suddenly, they found themselves understanding things differently than they had when they first came. Suddenly, they were converted. They were a part of the New Testament Church of God. God had called them into the body of Christ. They did not want to go home right away. They wanted to stay and become solidified in the doctrine and the teaching of the apostles. And that's what's stated here in this chapter and the next. In order for them to stay longer, they needed to be provided for. There were brethren who lived in Judea and Samaria who had wealth, who were willing to shed a lot of their wealth in order to get the work of the Church of God going. This is not Christian communism. This was a great expedient, a necessity of launching the work of God. It is not a form of government. It was just a way to make sure that the newly converted brethren were locked solid into the truth of God before they went away and back to their homes in their distant lands. Barnabas was one of those who particularly had donated a great deal of his wealth so that others could stay and learn for a longer period of time before they had to be dispersed back to where they came from. Now, moving back from that, because I think we do need to address that when we talk about forms of government, bear in mind this passage is viewed as Christian communism, and it predates Karl Marx by many centuries. So it probably factored into the thinking, even though Marx was Jewish and would have rejected the New Testament, the concept is there. Now, let's look at communism again. What's the shortcoming of communism? Do they distribute to everyone? The idea is to share the wealth evenly among the workers. Is that what happened? What is the great failing of communism? The great failing of communism is a question. Who gets to be the government? That's where the wealth is shared, for the party in power. It isn't shared with the average person. Back in 1972, Russia had one of their repeated crop failures because they were abysmal. The communist government were abysmal farmers. And there was this cartoon in a news magazine. The two communists are walking down the street, or the two Russians, and they said, "Well, Alexis, the reason we have no bread is because we had to send aid to the starving Americans. They had a crop failure." That's what they were told, you see. The Russian people are marvelous in their ability to put up with such idiots for leadership. With all due respects, such as it might be. Well, let's take communist light now. Let's look at the next one. Socialism. Socialism is the same as communism, only better English, said George Bernard Shaw, a playwright in the 1930s. George Bernard Shaw was a friend of Winston Churchill's, and one time he wrote a play, and he sent Winston Churchill two tickets. He said, "New play opening tonight," was a telegram. "Here are two tickets. Bring a friend if you have one." Which at the time, he was short on friends. Churchill immediately wired back to him. He said, "Impossible to make opening night. Would love to come second night if there is one." Okay, socialism, basically, government owns all the business and almost all the property. Very, very limited amount of free enterprise allowed. Again, it's communist light, what it is. Extremely high taxes on the rich. Government provides all the basic services, education, health care, you know, cradle to grave, womb to tomb coverage. Much less personal freedom than the USA is used to. Now, here's Winston Churchill's analysis. He was not a socialist, did not advocate it, fought it in the 1950s when it began to encroach upon Great Britain. He said, "Socialism is a philosophy of failure, the creed of ignorance and the gospel of envy. Its inherent virtue is the equal sharing of misery." You know, one of the big arguments to try to push socialism onto a nation is class envy. Get the poor to envy the wealthy and so on, and then they'll vote it in, so to speak, which is what is trying to be happening to America now. We've been on that road for quite a long time, actually. Here's a similar statement that Churchill once made again about it. He said, the inherent vice of capitalism, now there are some that say capitalism has no vices. We'll address that because that's our last form of government to look at. The inherent vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings. But the inherent virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of miseries. Sort of a restatement of what he said before. So it's, in a sense, socialism is communist light. But what's the shortcoming of socialism? Does it truly distribute the wealth more fairly? Is it genuinely interested in providing social justice, which the idealists think? No, the problem with socialism is who gets to be the government. Those who are in power will do what they want, and they seem to get very wealthy. Same with the communists. And nobody else does. So technically, it isn't the equal sharing of miseries, because those who have the power don't have the misery economically. All right, let's look at fascism. This was Hitler's type of government, which was another form of socialism. National Socialist Party, essentially, is what it was. In that, the government owns most of the business. It didn't own it all. There was almost an economic oligarchy in Nazi Germany. But it holds overarching ownership on all property. The people exist in a fascist state. They exist to serve the government. Interestingly, if you get down to the core philosophy of socialism or communism, it's the same. The people exist for the whim of the government. The power of the executive is the way Churchill analyzed that. Bear in mind, he fought Nazism more than anybody else in the world, probably. He fought it with an army of words, in addition to, you know, as I said, running the free world for the first half of World War II. The power of the executive to cast a man into prison without formulating any charge known to the law, and particularly to deny him the judgment of his peers, is in the highest degree odious and is the foundation of all totalitarian government, whether Nazi, as he used to call them, or communist. In other words, complete frivolous oppression of the population at the whim and fancy of who's ever in charge. All the basic services provided by the Nazi government, very similar to socialism, very, very limited personal freedoms, typified by a charismatic leader who tends to be idolized fanatically. Shortcoming? Who gets to be the Führer, the leader? Same thing as the other two, isn't it? Now let's look at a monarchy. Human monarchy, not the divine monarchy of Jesus Christ. That's different, and there's a big reason why. In an absolute monarchy, which is typically the kind of monarchies kings wanted to have over the years, often they didn't. Most lately we've had constitutional monarchies, which is what Great Britain is. But in an absolute monarchy, the king owns everything, including all the people. Well, that doesn't sound very different from communism, socialism, or fascism. Limited free enterprise is allowed at the caprice of the king. Whatever he allows is okay. If he doesn't allow it, it's taken away. The king provides all the services for the population, if any. If any. Depends on the king. If he's a good king, he's fair. If it's a bad king, he's not fair. Look back at ancient Israel. Good kings and bad kings. What did they have mostly? Bad kings. The house of Israel had nothing but bad kings. The northern 10 tribes, they started with Jeroboam, and every king after that was described as following the sins of Jeroboam, except one, the last one. Ironically, the last king, just before they went into captivity to Assyria. He's the one king that maybe wasn't quite as bad as some of the other ones. Go figure. Personal freedoms under an absolute monarchy at the whim and fancy of the king, the shortcoming. Who gets to be the king? The power is not shared. The economic wealth is not shared. The crown owns it all. Now, what about an egocentric dictatorship? Haven't we just described it? The absolute monarchy, fascism, socialism, communism, it's all of the above, no matter what they call it. In an egocentric dictatorship, who gets to be the dictator is the shortcoming. That's the way of man. Never fair. And yet there are, you know, mankind wants fairness, wants social justice. Now, what about democratic capitalism? Remember, we're looking at the governmental forms, particularly from the perspective of the economic policies. In democratic capitalism, the people have an organized way to select leaders to represent them. Now, we're familiar with that. That's more or less a description of America. The government provides limited services, national security, part of the education, etc. It is a free enterprise economy because you can have private ownership of property that you don't have in many other forms of government. free enterprise capitalist. His focus seems to be preeminently focused on capitalism. Personal responsibility is expected for self-governing. There's an energetic work ethic that actually goes along with free enterprise. We'll see that shortly. There is considerable freedom and opportunity. Abraham Lincoln described it as a government for the people. That is, that at the nucleus of the philosophy, there is the concept that the government should serve the people. The people don't exist simply to serve the government. In all the other forms, they exist simply to serve the government. Otherwise, they're cannon fodder. People are not respected. In the democratic capitalism, at least they are respected. It has a limitation, however. It has a shortcoming. And the shortcoming is whether or not it uses the power that it has. The leaders use their power wisely. Winston Churchill did once compliment America, though. He said, "You can always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else." Interesting. Okay, those are your basic forms of government. I know that there are other forms if we want to get technical about it, but those they get the general gist of every other form of government that man has tried from time to time. Now, let's analyze them. No, let's not let it analyze them. Let's let Christ analyze them for us in Luke chapter 22. I don't know if you realize that, but he did an analysis of all the world's forms of governments. And it was in the process of teaching a very important lesson to the disciples who were always vying for who got to be, you know, the top cat or the top dog, as it might be, on the right hand and on the left hand of the Messiah. Of the true Messiah, not the false messiahs. Most of the forms of government, by the way, are based on Messiah concepts. The dictators market themselves as savior messiahs, counterfeits of essentially what Jesus Christ is. That's the way they've done. That's what Hitler did. That's what Stalin did. That's what Robert Mugabe has done in Zimbabwe. That's what Pol Pot did in the killing fields of Cambodia in the late 1970s. They're always the Messiah. There's some dictator that claims to be the be-all and the end-all. And there is a fanatic obsession with those kinds of leaders. Their photographs are everywhere. And they're not little photographs. They're big ones, all over the crowds, on every wall. Banners with their face hanging down. You saw that in Nazi Germany. They all copy that, by the way. The Nazis copied Mussolini of Italy. But Mussolini wasn't as good at it as the Germans were. They took it a notch higher, and then all the dictators followed suit and hung the visage of themselves where all their people could, you know, fanatically obsess and idolize them, or theoretically so. Saddam Hussein did that. Remember how many statues and banners American soldiers tore down back in 2003? And, well, in the Iraqi people helped them. Here's Christ's analysis of the world's forms of governments, Luke chapter 22, verse 24. Whoops. I have a new Bible and I turned too many pages. "Now there was a dispute among them," being the disciples, "as to which of them should be considered the greatest," and next to Christ, in other words. "And so he said to them," In the other accounts, it was James and John, and their mother wanted one of them to be in his right hand and one in his left hand, and then everybody got mad at James and John, the sons of Zebedee, all the disciples did. So this is the same incident just told by Luke. The kings, here's what Christ said. "The kings," or in Matthew it's the rulers, "the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors." The kings or rulers of the Gentile exercise lordship over them. Who's them? Well, whoever they rule, that's who them is. They're people. What did he mean, exercise lordship? He meant throw their weight around. Smash people to the right and the left with their authority. Wield it generally mercilessly. Generally. There are a few who didn't, but most did. And those who are their leaders are called benefactors, some great exalted title. You know, the communists did that. They would give those long, long, long names to their countries. The USSR was a classic case in point. United Soviet Socialist Republic. It wasn't a republic at all. But they were trying to be the masters of deception. And there were plenty of people that suckered for it. And maybe even Americans early on thought that, the Soviet thing was the ideal. That's the way government should be. Later, they mostly changed their minds. Not all, mind you, but mostly. But they call themselves benefactors. That's how Adolf Hitler marketed himself to his people. That's how Saddam Hussein marketed himself to his people. Routinely, they give themselves great exalted titles. Christ said, "Not going to happen among you. Don't you dare do that. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves." Oh, that is different. In other words, if you're in a leadership position in the government of God, you're there to serve those you rule. You serve their needs. You lead them, but that leadership is to be a service. The opposite, the world's way, the Gentile way is described here, is they exist to serve you, and you lead them, and do whatever you want with them. And Christ said, no, you have responsibility for their good. Who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is not he who sits at the table, yet I am among you as one who serves. Uses his own example. But you are those who have continued with me in my trials, and I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me. So Christ gave a prophecy to the 12 apostles that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Is it important to know who the 12 tribes generally are? I would say so. Christ seemed to think it was important. If you esteem his opinion well, then I think you can see the importance also. Now, you know, he compared himself to Gentile leadership. Non-Israelite is what Gentile means. And you look at world history, non-Israelite leadership has been oppressive, typically, except with rare exceptions. Israelite leadership, especially when Israelite descended nations have had a dominant sway in world events, is much more responsible. It's not perfect or all wise, as Churchill accurately said, but it is more responsible. And I think that the foil to Gentile is normally Israelite, and so there's a lesson that can be learned from what we just read there. Now, let's look at the shortcoming of democratic capitalism. It's found in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. America is a democratic capitalist state. Representative republic, but, you know, we use the general term democratic, in a connotation of it these days. Chapter 3 and verse 5 of Colossians, "Therefore put to death your members which are on the earth," meaning your behaviors, "fornication, uncleanness, passion," the wrong kind of passion, obviously, "evil desire, and covetousness," which is idolatry. Covetousness has another name, it's called greed. And unfortunately, economically, we have seen many greedy people in America. Opportunity exists in the structure of government that we have, really and overall been blessed with and has provided a springboard for God's work at the end of the age. And some will take the opportunity to worship wealth. And there have been some. And to be oppressive, when the railroads were built across to the American West, probably this existed as well in some of the railroad systems back here, but it was very bad out there. When they finally drove the Golden Spike and united the Union Pacific and whatever the other railway was in Utah, there were four men who set the rates for shipping freight and people on the train. They also had a line that ran down the length of California and up into the Northwest to some degree. They set rates that were so oppressive that you had to be subservient to the railroad for years to come to pay the debt to go west. They were called the railroad robber barons. And finally, their dominant influence in the rate setting of the railways was broken, and they lost some of their wealth, but they squelched the development economically of the West significantly. The line that ran down California, and we know this because of Camp High Sierra, used to have a cabin on it, and the cabin was the common hideout of outlaws, and particularly two famous ones who robbed the train. They robbed the train because the train took their ranches. It got every other section of land along the rail line. And they just confiscated whoever land they wanted, and it was in their way. They lost enterprise, their ranch, their place to live and make a living. And so they took to robbing the train, and it was very hard to catch them, because they would ride up into Tulare County, into the High Sierras. They'd hide in the cabin. When they found out the cabin was there, then they'd hide out with other people. And everybody protected them. For a long time, those two got away from the law, simply because the people knew why they did what they did. We don't sanction what they did, robbing the train. Like I said, it's politics, schmolitics. And I'll tell you one thing for sure, it's a marvelous thing that our future is not banking on the politics of this nation or any other nation. I think we need to think about that. Jesus Christ said, "My kingdom is not of this world." It's John 18:36. Ought to be a memory scripture. "If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I shouldn't be delivered from the Jews. But my kingdom isn't from here. This is not my kingdom. Ours is the kingdom of God." Oh, and it's so much difference. Now, as we analyze we're going to get to the government of God's policies. We need to understand two elements. Mankind, in his forms of government, including liberal democracy that we have in America and in most of the other sort of democratic-type states in the country or in the world right now, they have a fundamental misconception. They think the human nature is basically good. That's the philosophy at the core of classic liberalism. I'm not speaking of our political variety, although it's true because it borrowed it. This goes back to the period of the Enlightenment in the 1600s when philosophies begin to change and people begin to challenge the thinking of the Roman Church at that time. But they think that government or that human nature is basically good. The Bible says the human heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Well, anybody that wants to know it can. It's right there in Jeremiah 17:9. Also in Jeremiah 10 and verse 23, Jeremiah says, "O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his steps." That is also true as far as his forms of government. We don't represent the forms of government of this world at all. There's one other failing, though, that in our era of the beginning of the 21st century and the end of the 20th and now well into the 21st, one of the great failings of all the governments, including the one in this country, is typified by the story of the communist potatoes. Some of you know the story of the communist potatoes, but I'm banking on some of you not knowing the story of them. It went like this. This was back in the day of Stalin's regime, and the party leader around Moscow decided that he needed some potatoes grown so they could make more vodka. They make vodka out of potatoes, and they love vodka there. So he called his friend who ran a collective farm not far from the city, and he said, "Alexis, I want you to grow some potatoes so we can make more vodka." So out he went. He planted the potatoes. Everybody got busy. Finally, at the end of the season, the Communist Party leader called him in. He said, "So, Alexis, tell me, comrade, how did the potatoes grow?" He said, "Oh, comrade party leader, the potatoes grew like you've never seen before. In 2 weeks, they were waist high." Never seen them grow that fast. In 4 weeks, they were taller than the equipment parked across the field waiting for spare parts for 5 years. They had a real problem with that back then. Inefficient form of government. And he says, Commandant Party Leader, those potatoes grew and grew until they were taller than our barns. They grew into the sky and the clouds. These potatoes, like you've never seen before, grew to the very feet of God. Comrade Party Leader looked at him and said, Comrade Alexis, you know there is no God. And Alexis replied, yes, comrade, and there are no potatoes either. The greatest pitfall of all man's forms of governments is that they don't believe in God, and further, they don't believe God. Now, let's jump into the forms of government that Jesus Christ will have, the form of government he will have, and specifically we're going to look at the economic policies that we will be administering. We already know what they are. I have a list. The first one is this. We could state them as laws because they are in fact laws. The law of primary divine ownership. It's found in Leviticus 25 and verse 23. Actually, most of the laws are in Leviticus 25 and a couple of other places. Chapter 25 of Leviticus, verse 23. It has an economic consideration. It talks about how land can be bought and sold. But within it is the other law. The land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, and you are strangers and sojourners with me. It is the law of divine primary ownership. God owns everything, and we are his settlers, if you will. Understanding that God owns everything is what all the rest of it is based upon. These are not in a specific order, but I have saved my two or three of the favorite ones for the end. The second law is the law of tithes, is the tax. The law of tithes as the tax. And I said tithes because, of course, the first tithe is the tax. The second tithe is, I don't know if you want to call it a vacation education fund that God built into the system for his people to come and worship him at the holy day times, like the Feast of Tabernacles, the festival tithe, education, vacation, spiritual development, enriching the lives and the minds of his people. So the law of tithes as the tax is the second of God's economic laws. You know the scriptures on that one. Festival tithe is covered in Deuteronomy 14. Lots of other places talk about the first tithe. Matthew 3:10 is the big challenge. Prove me now herewith, if I will not open the doors of heaven and pour out upon you blessings such as you can't hold, if you pay the tithe faithfully. See, we have these economic policies governing us right now. We have two governments. We have man's government from wherever we are. We're mostly from America, but then we have God's government, which is the primary one, and the one we're preparing to be involved in. Number three, it is the law of private ownership and private enterprise. Granted, it is under the umbrella of primary divine ownership, but it is the law of private ownership and private enterprise. And you stop and think, okay, how can I know that? Well, let's turn to the part of the Bible that fell out of mine. I got a brand new Bible, and the other day I was turning to one of the prophecies during one of the sermons, and Micah came out of my hand. It wasn't stitched in. It's supposed to be really nice binding. Oh, well, I stuck it back in there for now. I hope I put it in the right place. Micah chapter 4. I suppose if I just held it up and shook it, he'd fall back out again. Yep, there it is. Slip sliding away. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established at the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. And you say, hold it, that's in Isaiah. Yep, chapter 2. Isaiah and Micah seem to know each other. And I think one was quoting the other. But I don't know which one. Probably Micah was quoting Isaiah. In fact, it goes on to be remarkably close right through verse 3 to Isaiah 2. Very, very close. However, verse 4, Micah was given the opportunity by God to put in something added. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. His vine and his fig tree. Communism, that's the government's vine and fig tree. Socialism, that's the government's vine and fig tree. Dictatorship, it's the dictator's vine and fig tree. Absolute monarchy, it's the king's vine and fig tree. But in the world tomorrow, it will belong to whomever owns that piece of property. Granted, there's an overarching divine ownership, even of the vine and the fig tree. But it is private ownership and thus private enterprise. Suppose you have an intensely prolific fig tree and others don't pay much attention to their fig trees except to sit under it, and they grow flowers and they're hungry. You can swap figs for nasturtiums. Aren't nasturtiums the edible flowers? Yeah, the French eat them all the time. Brings his girl a bouquet of flowers and she grabs them and starts munching away. And he was an American, and he's stunned. What's happening? Well, there's salad over there, those particular flowers. So you see, the fig tree could be a private enterprise as well as being privately owned. Now, quick aside, this economic policy and the law of private ownership and private enterprise also affects the way cities get laid out. More on that later. Number 4, the law of hard work. What do you mean, the law of hard work? Well, isn't that what communism and socialism and all the other isms, except for the dictator thing, they claim that you don't have to work, especially if you're poor, the rich are going to give you what you need. No, everybody works in God's way. Everybody who can does. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. It's not whatever you find your hand finds to do, make your neighbor do it with his might. It's not that. Do it with your might. So the law of hard work, that goes along with private ownership and private enterprise. Responsibility. Get up and do what needs to be done. Wonderful. Now, number 5 is the law of caring for the poor. Jesus once said, the poor you will always have with you. There will always be some. For whatever reason. Could be health. And you think, well, can't we just heal everybody in the world tomorrow? Well, they'll be generally healthier, I'm sure. What about those who are of great age? I mean, you just do wear out after a while. You know, there will be some who need it. Now, God provides for that. He already thought of that. You know, all the governmental forms that are singing the praises of the wonderful welfare state, economic ruin that it brings later, they don't have a clue, because of the communist potatoes, they don't have a clue that God already had a plan for that. And it's a balanced plan, Deuteronomy 14. Perfect plan. Democracy, as Churchill said, is neither perfect nor all-wise. Theocracy, where God rules in the world tomorrow, is perfect. And it is all wise. And we get to have a direct involvement with it. Okay, it's in verse 28 and 29. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it within your gates. At the end of every third year. Does that mean you only have to pay the tithe in the third year? No, you got to read it all in context, and that's not what it was saying. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work that your hand which you do. This is a third tithe, as we've called it. It's only paid in the third year. Well, it's not really technically every third year. Let me explain. It is the third year and the sixth year in a seven-year cycle. God operates on seven-year cycles in His government. We'll get to that one. That's the land Sabbath. And you think, well, how do you know it's the third and sixth? How come it isn't just 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3? Well, go to year 21, and you have a third tithe year during a land Sabbath, and there's no income. So it doesn't work. So it's got to be third and sixth years within the seven-year cycle. That way, it's a steady provision of a welfare fund and food, if you will, for those who are genuinely in need. Does that mean people can just, as they say in England, skive off? That means be lazy? No. The Apostle Paul was inspired to cover that in 2 Thessalonians. If they can work, they will work. After they miss lunch and breakfast. And this ought to govern how we conduct our own lives. So we need to have a good, solid work ethic in God's church. Did I say 1 Thessalonians? I meant 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 10 and 11. They had a problem in Thessalonica. There were some people that decided that Christ had already returned, so they quit their jobs and just hung out. Didn't do anything. For even when we were with you, in verse 10, it says, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. There seems to have been a societal problem in Thessalonica of just generally laziness. They were a little bit like the Cretans, who were slow bellies and evil beasts. And I'm not picking on Cretans. That was Epimenides. He was picking on the Cretans because he was one. And he knew what they were. Paul was quoting him. Now, that's an aside. Literature in the Bible. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. Well, the welfare program of God's church, because what Paul just cited there is a fundamental, understood element back in Deuteronomy 14. Those who can work will work. It's workfare. If they are having troubles, well, then give them some work to do. Those who are unable to work, that's a different story. You carry those who are weak physically. But those who can, then they must do. Those who can do, must do. So the law of care for the poor is very clearly laid out as one of the economic policies in the world tomorrow, and it is not one that will consume because it promotes laziness on a vast scale, and the Western world has been plagued with that for decades now. They became what they call the welfare states, and it has been a disaster economically. Now, there's some other aspects. We go back to Deuteronomy 25 this time. It is called the law of just weights. He said, well, how is that an economic policy? Well, it is. It has to do with, soundness of the currency, whatever the currency will be. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 13. You shall not have in your bag differing weights, a heavy and a light, so that when you are trading, say, barley for, something else, when you're weighing the barley that you're going to sell, you put a light weight on the scale, and so you short them the fair amount of barley. You're supposed to just have one weight, an even weight, an official one, and only use that. You shall not have in your bag differing measures, a large and a small. You shall have a perfect and just weight, a perfect and just measure, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So this is very much an economic policy. And the, you know, the integrity of weights and measures, as well as the integrity, therefore, of currencies, is that's even understood in virtually every form of government today. This is one thing they do have some idea of. They don't necessarily practice it, but they have an idea of it. We have a lot better idea, though. For all who do such things and all who have behave unrighteously are an abomination to the Lord your God. And when you read in the Proverbs that a false weight is mentioned, it's almost mentioned every time in the Proverbs, over and over again, along with the word abomination. God hates that kind of cheating. Now, that's a very, very much an economic policy of the world tomorrow. People will have fair measures. Now, here's another one. This is back in our primary chapter of the 25th chapter of Leviticus. This is number 7. The law of just weights was number 6. Number 7 is the law of no usury. That is, interest charged on a loan. Not usury in the sense that we usually use usury today, which is exorbitant interest, like your credit card company is charging you. You know how to stop them from doing that? Pay the bill every month. I have no interest in credit cards in that way. We have some and we use them. But some of you may have been rudely surprised, they can capriciously raise those to exorbitant rates for almost no reason. Leviticus 25 and verse 35. If one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him, like a stranger or a sojourner that may live with you. And no, take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God that your brother may live with you. And you shall not lend him your money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Remember that. If one of your people needs loan of something fundamental, then you can't charge usury. What that then is provides economic opportunity. Those who are struggling to get going, maybe starting a family or fell upon hard times for some reason and just need a little loan to get going, then you can give them the loan. You're commanded to give them the loan if you have the ability to, but you can't charge them interest. The family farm in America nearly died at the end of the 1970s. From basically 78 to 81, interest rates were at Visa and MasterCard rates for operating loans, 21% for most of that time. There were many small family farms, which were really the backbone industry of America, that died during those years. I know, ours did. My father fought a delaying action for 10 years. And finally, the family farm went bankrupt in the early 90s. You could never get past the fanatical interest rates they were charging. Now, one thing that we find here, and we need to turn to Deuteronomy 23 for this, you can charge interest of non-Israelites. And you think, well, what kind of discrimination is that? It's not. Think about it in the world tomorrow. First, Christ deals with the tribes of Israel, back in the Promised Land. Gets them settled, gets them going, and then we start to evangelize the rest of mankind, the rest of the non-Israelite nations, which are the Gentiles, the Goyim, and which simply means the nations. Israel is the nation. They are the nations. Now, all they have to do is look at Israel and realize, you know, if I attach myself to Israel, even though I am a Gentile of whatever tribal background or national background, if I attach myself to Israel, then I don't get charged interest either. Bingo. That's exactly the point. Deuteronomy, did I say 23? It's verse 19 and 20 of that chapter. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. Now, this is indicating that it has to do primarily with basic food, basic life supplies. It's not talking about a business loan. To a foreigner, you may charge interest, but to your brother, you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you set your hand to do, which you're entering, the land you're entering to possess. But if the foreigner says, hey, I want to be counted as an Israelite, then you can't charge him interest either. That's a good thing. That's a positive motivation. It builds this law, this economic policy of God's government. We look in Luke chapter 6 for this. It builds an attitude of societal generosity built into the structure because of this policy. It's Luke chapter 6, verse 32. If you love those who love you, what credit is it to you? For even the sinners love those who love them. These are the words of Christ. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even the sinners do the same. But if you lend to those from whom you can, you hope... Let me reread this. Let me pick it up and read it. If you lend to those from whom you hope to receive back, what credit is that to you? For even sinners lend to sinners to receive much back. See, the implication is, but if you lend, not expecting to receive back, no interest, no usury. Ah, then that's doing good. Therefore, in verse 36, be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. This is an economic policy of mercy. It does not apply, however, to commercial loans for businesses, and that is made clear in the parable of the minas. The minas were little birds that can talk. Sorry, that's not what I'm talking. Wrong minas. The minas are the people who go down in tunnels and bring out gold. Wrong ones again. It's a coin in Greece. I think it was called the Parable of the Pounds back when it was the King James translation. But it's over in chapter 19 of Luke, and for reference, the verses, verse 23. Why then did you not put my money in the bank that at my coming I might have collected it with interest? You know, the commercial ventures can have interest charged for them. That's fine. But interests that have to do with hearth and home, no. No interest charged. It does not sanction laziness or taking advantage of others' generosity. Remember, you no worky, you no eaty. Is what the Apostle Paul said. Now we're looking at number 8, law of land inheritance. I'm going to give you the reference, since I covered it yesterday in principle. We'll again tomorrow. Numbers 26:52. And the following verses. Each tribe of the 12 tribes, when they entered the land of Canaan and conquered it, they were given land allotments based on the size of the tribe. Big chunks to large tribes and so on. Small chunks, smaller tribes. And then they distributed the land to the families within the tribe. And that land was an inheritance, an estate of the family, that could not be sold in perpetuity. The law of land inheritance. What you just did is you distributed wealth across the population. One of the things that communism claimed to do and socialism claims to do, and every stinking dictator that came down the line claimed to do, is that he would cause land reform and distribute the land to the masses. And the masses believed it. Or believe them. And typically they didn't do it. They distributed it to their friends, or they kept it for themselves. But God already had that law in place. What an economic boon that will be for society in the world tomorrow. Every family will own a family land they can never get rid of because it always comes back. Then we come to the land Sabbath. This is number 9. It's in Leviticus 25. Verse 1, you know, we don't talk much about the land Sabbath these days in the church. We used to have a lot of farmers in the church, I mean, decades ago, who aren't farming anymore, retired or moved off the farm, whatever happened. So we don't discuss this. But this is an incredible policy. First seven verses of Leviticus 25. When you come into the land that I give you, in verse 2, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 days you sow your field, six years you'll sow your field, and 6 years prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But the seventh year there will be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not sow nor prune your vineyard. Whatever grows of its own accord of your harvest, you cannot reap it, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. It's a year of rest for the land. In verse 6, the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you. Whatever comes ripe, you know, the strawberries come out or the fruit, it's going to grow on the trees. You can eat it while it's in season, but you can't store any. If you have any volunteer growth in your garden, you can eat that, but you can't harvest it to store. You can graze, however, your livestock as usual. Now, what does the land Sabbath mean economically? Number one, to review what it means, no crops can be planted specifically for harvesting, so it builds the soil fertility. It's not working. The cropland isn't working on that Sabbath. No grain may be harvested for commercial purposes. And you think, well, what are you going to run out of grain? No. Later in the chapter, it explains God gives a double blessing in the sixth year. So you have more than enough grain to carry you through to the harvest of the first year of the new cycle. No hay or winter fodder may be collected into barns. No fresh fruit or vegetables will be available for sale. Whoops, no fresh fruit or vegetables available for sale. What are the grocery stores going to sell? Same kind of plastic food they have today? No, I don't think so. You're not going to have the mega grocery store system that we have. That's not going to exist in the world tomorrow. With apologies to Kroger's and Superwall and et cetera, et cetera. The produce of the land will also be for the wildlife. It'll be a huge boon for upland birds and all kinds of birds and animals, small animals. You have a year of untended vines and fruit trees. The trees get to, you know, more vigor instilled in them when they don't get pruned every year. The land Sabbath, they don't get pruned. But the fruit's everywhere. So anything that eats it thrives. So it gives you much more wildlife. We have the double blessing in the sixth year. Now, the implications economically. Agriculture will be pasture-based. You can graze to your heart's content. No, not you, but your cattle. Unless you're Nebuchadnezzar and you're a little bit off in the noggin. That will encourage livestock-based agriculture, not the grain monoculture of today, which is a famine waiting to happen. All you have to do is have a disease go through that knocks out a huge percentage of one or two of your grain crops, and we're in serious trouble. It won't be that in the world tomorrow. Grain will actually be a much smaller commodity in the world tomorrow. A lot more protein available. One of the worst diseases in the world today is kwashiorkor. Malnutrition due to a lack of protein. The land Sabbath maintains true soil fertility. Consequently, chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, and the fertilizer industry out of business. Gone, gone, gone. You know, they're already out of business in some of the really poor countries in the world today that grow coffee. I happen to know this because I happen to drink it. And if you buy coffee that isn't, say, it's organic, but it comes from a country that you happen to know is very poor, it's also organic. They can't afford fertilizers and the chemical sprays and all the pesticides that really get dumped on the wealthier coffee-producing companies or countries. Greengrocers who have fruits and vegetables for sale, that'll be out of business in the seventh year. So it's not going to be the green grocery business of today. But then again, it won't be quite as needed because you got a fig tree. You can always go out and eat off your fig tree. You're sitting under it. You just pluck those figs, lay there, and they fall in your mouth. Eat figs to your heart's content. You get thirsty, eat some grapes. They're growing right beside you because you're vine and fig tree, remember? Consequently, every family will need at least some land around their home to provide fresh fruit and veggies in season in the seventh year. That will affect urban development. You're not going to be all squeezed together, like it says in Isaiah 5:8, woe to those who add house to house, which can be interpreted as being all squeezed together, like rats in a box. There'll be more elbow room, freedom for kids, places for them to run and play safely. Lots of economic opportunity. Creative. What are you going to do in the seventh year? Well, we know what we're going to do. We're going to be teaching and doing what we normally do with the Spirit. But what will a people do in the seventh year? Learn? Art? Write poetry, songs, study music. They'll have some more extra time, and that can be put to a very good use. Just think of a seven-year system where the whole population gets added education because they have the time in the seventh year, and they're all doing it at the same time. This is not, you know, you do it in your seventh year, I do it in my seventh year. It's everybody at the same time. Huge change. The year of release, I'll let you read this one on your own. It's in chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. It's the same year. Every seventh year, all debts are canceled. All personal debts, it appears, are canceled. Likewise, where there has been an indentured servitude established because of a debt, you serve off your debts. In that sense, you work off your debts instead of having your debts dumped. They are dumped in the seventh year, and those who are working off their debt are freed in the seventh year to go about their business. And they are, and you read about it, and it's Deuteronomy 15, verses 1 to 11. Let you savor that one. In fact, you notice that there's an addendum to it. That's number 10. Number 11 is the law of educational indentured servanthood, long-term servanthood, instead of the short-term. But the year of release, to get back to the number 10 one again for a moment, when all debts are canceled every seventh year, just stop and think what that does. That's what our bankruptcy laws try to mimic badly, but they try. They're based on the year of release principle of the Bible, but unfortunately poorly based. God has a better system, and we'll be instituting it, and people will be living by it. It'll be marvelous. In chapter 25 of Leviticus, we find the 11th law, which is educational indentured servanthood. This is longer servanthood because in the 50th year, you have seven Sabbaths of 7 years, seven times seven, and then you have a 50th year, just like we count Pentecost. In the 50th year is the Jubilee, and that's when these are in this long-term indentured servitude, are freed to go back to their family and back to their land. Now, they can stay with whoever they want to stay with. But we have here a system that stops this repetition where you have those who get into the mentality of, I'm not worth anything, I can't do anything, I'll never accomplish anything, get out of that. All they have to do is go to somebody who obviously is accomplished and say, I need to work for you. You know, minimum amount is fine, I just need room and board and a little to live on and provide for my family, but I need to learn how to manage my affairs better. And those who are successful, teach them. That's a responsibility they have. And that breaks that cycle, which eventually leads to what we call a welfare cycle. It breaks that before it gets started. And then in the 50th year, they're free to go. For those who are in the long-term program, the short-term program, it's every seventh year. But I want to get now to our final one, the law of the Jubilee. This is number 12, and it starts in verse 8. You count seven Sabbaths of years for yourself, seven times 7 years. That'll be 49 years. And then you'll make the trumpet to sound, of the Jubilee to sound, on the 10th day of the seventh month, on the Day of Atonement. You'll make the trumpet sound in all your generations. And it'll be a 50th year will be consecrated. It'll be a Jubilee, and you'll each return to your own possession, and each of you to his family. It's a time of liberty, opportunity, freedom, new start. 50th year will also be a land Sabbath. So the 49th year is a land Sabbath and the 50th year. You have a double land Sabbath, back to back. Just like we have a double Sabbath when we have Pentecost on that weekend. For it is the Jubilee in verse 12, and it will be holy to you. You can eat whatever comes up in, you know, volunteer growth, though. And you'll each return to his possession in verse 13. And if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor's hand, you will not oppress one another. For the number of years of the Jubilee is all you can charge for the land that you're selling. If you're 35 years away from the Jubilee, your land has 35 years of value to the person buying. That's what they have to pay. If it's 49 years from the Jubilee, then it's more. If you want to buy it back and it goes through then explaining how that works, you can buy it back at any time. You can redeem it or your family can redeem it. But you know that when the Jubilee comes, your family gets their land inheritance back. And then the grandchildren, typically by that time, or maybe the children, will have this windfall of wealth back in their laps to start the business, to return to the land, to farm if they want to, or continue if they wanted, if they're a tradesman of some other type of trade in the city. They can continue in that, and they can lease it back out to whomever. It's basically, it's leasing the land. You can't sell the land. The land inheritance stays in the family, and that wealth returns every 50 years. All the other government forms that man has tried from time to time, they try to, they have the theory of spreading the wealth around, and they have no idea how to do it. God already did it. It's the land Sabbath and the Jubilee year. The wealth is spread out to the families who owned that land that they were given. And that will be happening at the onset of the millennium. It will be delivery of that land. That's a tremendous economic boon. It's the cyclic reinvestment of wealth across the population. And the world has never found a way to do that effectively without wars, usually. Wonderful economic opportunity, and it will diffuse tension between the absurdly rich and the profoundly poor. As those who are wealthy and maybe have accumulated a lot of land, most of it's leased. And at the 50th year, they don't own it anymore. They don't control it anymore. It goes back. And they got to renegotiate. And so it evens things out a bit. I hope you can see that God has already planned for an incredible economic process. His form of government does all this. His economic policies are marvelous. It reminds me very clearly, because of the freedom and the opportunity economically for the people we will govern at that time, reminds me of while Christ started his ministry. He quoted from Luke 4 is where it is, but he was quoting from Isaiah 61 or 62. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives. That will also apply to those who are in the long-term indentured servanthood. They will have their freedom to go and do what they want to do in the 50th year. And recovery of sight to the blind and set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And the acceptable year, in the context that we've been looking at, is the Jubilee year. Every 50th year during the 1,000 years of Christ's rule. God's government surpasses all the governments of man. The key is freedom from greed and from all other forms of oppression, and the key of spiritual as well as economic freedom. It's based on the way of give. It's based, therefore, on freedom and opportunity. The bottom line is this: because the power of God's Spirit converts human nature to the divine nature, that's the problem they don't do today, and due to Christ's wonderfully brilliant economic and other policies of leadership, the government of God is, in fact, the best form of government.